Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club and also our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight Michael Sheldon, the author of Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. I have to say that Michael has written at least four or five great biographies for those of you who aren't familiar, one on Mark Twain, one on George Orwell, right, and also Cyril Connolly and several others, all winning awards, all doing very well. And I think, you know, 3 years from now, there'll be another one, I'm sure. Right, Michael? So, but this is a great book. I've read it, and it's a great little look at what he did before he was 40 years old, but I'll let Mike tell you all about it. Michael Sheldon.
The photo that you see up here is the Churchill that all of us know. This is the Churchill that became famous. And most people don't realize that the fame that that Churchill established dates from the time he was 65 years old. So the famous Churchill, the Churchill that everyone knows, is a man 65 and older. And what interested me is how that man at 65 was able to summon so much energy, so much courage, so much resilience to do what he did in a period of great peril. And I wanted to understand how that man developed the kind of force of character that would be needed in a job like that. So I looked at the Churchill most of us don't know. It's a Churchill that most of us associate with the Edwardian period, if we know anything about it at all. And to understand that Edwardian man, I wanted to start with something that dates from the darkest hour of World War II. Because for me, the whole question of character, which is at the heart of my study of Churchill, my biography of him, is really at the heart of this particular moment. It's May the 9th, 1941, and a lot of people don't know that that was the worst night of the Blitz. As many of you know, the Blitz went on for many, many, many days and nights. And toward the end of the war, it involved rockets, V-1s and V-2 rockets. When I wrote a book about World War II and the literary magazine that was trying to operate at the time, the editor of that magazine could put up with the V-1 rockets, he said, because you could hear them coming. They were doodle bugs. You could hear the sound. They cut out, and then you knew to take cover. But the V-2 rockets were real rockets, and they made no sound. They just exploded. You didn't hear them coming, usually. And that was terrifying to most people in London. Well, that's from 1944-45. The Blitz, as we know it, the moment where a lot of these bombers are coming over London and just pounding the city, that's from this period from 1940 until 1941. And this is the worst night. And on that night, a lot of people don't realize, the Germans got very lucky. They would follow the river, the Thames River, into London. And on a moonlit night, as this one was, the moon would reflect off the water, and though the city was blacked out, they could use that reflection to guide them along. And as many of you know, the Houses of Parliament sit right alongside the river in Westminster, and they dropped their bombs, and a bomb got a lucky hit right on the House of Commons. When you watch C-SPAN today and you see the debates in the House of Commons, that's all rebuilt. Because on this particular night, as you can see from this photograph, they hit Westminster Abbey, they hit the Tower of Big Ben. It almost sounds like a song, doesn't it? And they killed and injured more than 3,000 people. And the street that you see up on the upper right-hand corner there is one of the streets to show you the devastation. So a September 11th, 2001, that was just one night of the Blitz, but it happened to be the worst night of the Blitz. And I consider the next photograph I'm going to show you to be the prelude to what I think is one of the great photographs ever taken in history. So to set that up for you, this is the House of Commons after that bomb hit it on Saturday night, May the 9th, 1941. It completely destroyed the entire place. I mean, down to the bare walls, they were scorched. And if you knew the House of Commons before this period, you knew that it was a grand place with lovely aisles going up five rows on either side, one for the opposition, one for the government, and a beautiful, nice center aisle that you walk down and then cross to your side. and lovely galleries above where the press could sit, visitors to the House of Commons could sit. And as you can see, the bomb came through the top, through the roof, and started a fire. Did a lot of destruction just from the explosion, but also then the fire finished off the work. And here's the photograph that I consider to be one of the great ones in human history. This is Winston Churchill, as you can tell, the old man, now 66, or going on 66. And he's walked into the House of Commons, and he looks about him, and there was more than just that man beside him there to record what his impression was. In my book, I describe as the prelude to my story, Winston standing there, and a single tear beginning to trickle down his cheek, and then they just flowed. And I make the point that he wasn't just crying because what had happened to the government. This is the seat of government. It's as though on 9/11 the terrorists had hit the Capitol and had destroyed it. You can imagine the effect that would have on morale, on everything else. And Churchill insisted on going there on the Sunday morning after that night. And he insisted on walking through into the rubble and looking around. And as he cried, he then dried his tears and he looked around and he said just these words, "We shall rebuild." He couldn't help sounding like Winston Churchill because that's the way he said things. And I love the fact that he's almost always in character. Somebody asked me about whether Churchill was Winston Churchill when he was 25, and I said, yes, he is. He comes out almost fully formed. He starts sounding like Winston Churchill in his speeches. He acts like Winston Churchill. And here at age 66, he's really being Winston Churchill because at this moment, I think most of us would be tempted to throw in the towel. Because he didn't know, and we wouldn't have known, that this was the worst night, that there wouldn't be no other night as bad as this one. There would be nights that were pretty bad when the V1 and V2 rockets began to fall. But nothing quite like this, where 3,000 people killed and injured, and the houses of Parliament hit, and the House of Commons completely destroyed. And as you stand in this rubble, if you're the Prime Minister, you begin to think, maybe we should seek peace. And recall that this is May of 1941. It's going to be another, 7 months before the United States enters the war. Britain is the only force opposing Hitler. And Hitler is 17 miles away on the coast of France. When I worked for many years for the Telegraph in London, the Daily Telegraph, and I was doing an interview there with a man whose mother owned property right overlooking the South Downs, and you could see out to the English Channel. And he happened to be the head of the British nuclear fleet. And I asked him if he thought that in 1940 or 41, the Germans had invaded on the very coast that we could look down and see, whether they would prevail. And he didn't hesitate. He said yes. And it would have been a terrible battle because I believe Churchill said later that at that time they only had 50 tanks that were operational in the entire British Isles to oppose any German invasion. So at this point, when you don't have any allies, and Hitler seems triumphant, and he's destroyed your House of Commons, you really would have to listen to advice that would say, seek a peace treaty. Because after all, that was why Churchill had come to power. The British were tempted to seek another peace treaty with the Germans, and of course the French had already done that. Somebody would have to be in England, the version of establishing a Vichy France, some sort of German-controlled area within the British Isles, and then some other part that was semi-autonomous. Churchill was not the man to do that. And when he walked away with even more resolve to continue the fight. For me, this is such an extraordinary photograph because not only do I see the public issue that you'd really be tempted if you're an ordinary human being to say this is it. I mean, what can we do? And seek counsel for coming to some sort of terms with Hitler. But also I understand what I've come to realize from writing this book, that man is not just standing in the seat of his government. He's standing in the middle of his career. For 40 years, he operated in that space. For 40 years, he built a career that didn't come to fruition as far as he was concerned, until he was made prime minister in 1940. My book begins with Winston walking onto that floor in 1901 as a 25-year-old MP, brand new, starting his career. And I know what he knew in that period. I know the battles he fought on that space. I know the people he knew on that space. And I know also that he felt an attachment to it because his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, had been an MP on that space and had made his career there too. So this is home to Winston. The Germans on this particular night have not just destroyed the House of Commons. They've destroyed a part, a huge part of Winston's life. And for those two reasons, both personal and political, I would have felt, Hitler had won that night. I would have thought, the bastard has won. And yet he was such a man that he didn't accept that at all. And the really important thing about understanding young Titan, the making of Winston Churchill, is how you get to that position in life, where at the darkest possible moment, you do not surrender. You do not give up. All of us, and it's an interesting human question, are tempted to throw in the towel at various points in relationships, in jobs, in all sorts of things. We say, well, that's enough. I've had it. And I think one of the biggest human questions is, how do you know when you've had it? How do you know when it's time to drop a job, a relationship? In my case, as a professor, I constantly wonder why students leave college. I don't see why they would. It seems to me a wonderful place. I've spent my entire life there, mostly. I like it. And yet you see people leave, and you say, why did you make that decision? Why did you give up? And I'm fascinated by the fact that Churchill, as you will see, would almost never give up on anything. Women that he proposed to, he was rejected 3 times. I don't know many men who, after being rejected 3 times, would try a 4th, but he did. And these were all new things about Churchill. I had to go out and kind of reconstruct this man. And when I was finished, as I hope you'll agree, I found another character that, for me now, there are two Churchills. There's the one who basically died at age 40. He thought he was going to die. He thought his life was over at age 40, and you'll see why. And then there's the second one that's very famous and triumphant. For me, I sort of lean toward the younger one. And here's your first introduction to him. He has hair. he's slender. And he's remarkable because he has a boy's freckled face at this age. We forget that he was a redhead. We forget that he was slender, that he played polo. And he was a very good polo player, by the way. He was smallish, around 5'8", just under 5'8". But an attractive man and full of himself, totally full of himself. I was doing an interview with Australian Broadcasting, ABC in Australia, and the fellow said to me, Churchill sounds as though he's full of himself. And I said, yes, he was. People used to ask me that about Mark Twain. I would say, yes, he was. And I would then add, if you had written Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, you would be full of yourself too. And this gives you this idea of this young titan. It's amazing that at an early age, he thought he had a destiny. He used to say, the stars in their courses guided my progress. He wasn't a particularly religious man, but he did have this sense of destiny. He knew something was out there waiting for him. We now know what it was, that he was going to be the one person uniquely qualified to stand in the path of Adolf Hitler when no one else was in that path. And don't, by the way, hesitate to understand the significance of that. There was no one else. And whatever Hitler would have accomplished, if he had taken England, that would have been disastrous. Because then even if the United States had decided to get in on the show later on, they would have had a difficult problem of launching invasions without England as their base, which of course made D-Day possible. So Churchill's willingness to fight on is crucial. And here you have this man who thinks something's waiting for him. He doesn't know quite what it is, but he's prepared for it almost from the beginning. And everyone kind of knows that. Look at this picture of him, where he's in his top hat and tails. This is his secretary, Edward Marsh, beside him. And I was stunned to find out that the press of the time was already referring to our future prime minister. The illustration on the right is taken from a contemporary magazine that in the early 1900s is already predicting this young man will be the youngest prime minister in British history. Everyone thought he'd be prime minister before he was 40, and he did too. But he was both loved early on and hated. He made a lot of enemies because he was full of himself. He was arrogant. He was a bit conceited. But he was also immensely charming. He was very, very intelligent. There's a great story I was just telling earlier about in his old age of sitting in the front row where Richard Burton is performing Hamlet in London, and Burton was disconcerted to look down and see Winston mouthing the words of his lines because he had memorized all of Hamlet. He had that kind of memory. And this kind of person can irritate because he's a know-it-all, but he can also be immensely attractive character because there's never a boring moment when you're with him. And you see him here on his horse. He was actually a very good horseman. And he was really a superior polo player. I'm not exaggerating about that. He was so ahead of his time and so highly regarded that here he is as a young man with the Kaiser. Now, why people sometimes say to me, isn't this sort of marginal to look at the young Winston? No, it isn't. This is terribly important because Adolf Hitler was a corporal in the German army in the trenches, a lowly loser, when Churchill was the head of the British Navy, when Churchill was wined and dined by the Kaiser, when Churchill was taken to observe the German military maneuvers in the early 1900s as almost a co-equal. The Kaiser, whose English was quite good, spoke very intelligently to Churchill about German plans, and Churchill took it very seriously. He was one of the earliest people to warn that there was a menace the country would have to face from Germany in 1914. Forget about 1940 or 1939. And I love the little cartoon on the right where this shows you how people would make fun of the fact that he was full of himself. They have Winston here in a cartoon in Punch magazine lecturing the Kaiser on maneuvering, how to run the German army. And there was one of the cartoons in Punch said that Winston wanted to reform the House of Commons, reform the army, reform the church, and reform the universe. So here he is, a young major in the British reserves lecturing the head of the German Empire. He was, though, primarily a politician, and he was a revolutionary, almost radical politician from the start. An American automobile magazine that I found made a point of saying, this has never been done before, campaigning from the top of a car. He stunned English audiences because this was seen as very American to do this, and yet even the Americans hadn't seen it. Winston, as you know, was the son of an American woman. His mother was American. And whenever anyone in England wanted to criticize him, they would often bring up that American side because they would say, this is that American in him coming out. If he was too aggressive, if he was too spectacular, this is not British reserve. And they understood that. This is a wonderful image of the young Titan at work here. He's going off to meet the king, and look at him in the back seat. You'd almost think he was the king. With his plumed helm, hat and his look of absolute smugness. And in fact, King Edward VII was both delighted and annoyed by Winston because Winston would lecture him. And the king wasn't in a mood for that. He had that attitude that almost no one was above him, that you were either an equal or somewhere farther down. Where does all this come from? Well, there's one big clue. It's this place. It's Blenheim Palace. If you've spent any time there, I have, and it's a magnificent place. To indicate how big it is, I tell people that the window washers, and yes, they have two men who wash the windows there, start at one window and a year later finish the last window. So it takes a year to wash the windows of Blenheim Palace. It is a piece of architectural, monumental tribute to Winston's ancestor, John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, and you couldn't live there without being aware of the fact that British history had been shaped by the Churchills. So he was born there, and if you go there, they will show you the room in which he was born, and you will be amazed to think that walking around that estate and walking through that enormous palace, Winston had this sense that there was something waiting for him. And you will sense that you couldn't grow up there without either being intimidated by your heritage or inspired by it. And Winston was definitely inspired by it. There was also another inspiration, and it was this woman. This is his American mother, Jenny. One woman described her as having the face of a panther. She had this dark, sensual look. I had always heard the rumor that she had a tattoo in the form of a serpent around her wrist, and I was determined to track down if that was true. I found three, the old journalist in me made me do this, I found three sources that corroborated it all. One of them was the New York Times, which in 1906, on a visit to America, noticed this and noticed how she used bracelets to hide it, to hide the tattoo in the form of a serpent around her wrist. She was an incredibly sensual, sexy lady who had many lovers. When her own husband, Lord Randolph, went off to seek other lovers, she was right behind him seeking her own. And as you may know, he died of syphilis at the age of 46, the complications of that. Somehow it never touched Jenny, and she went on to have many lovers. And in fact, when my story begins, rather shockingly, she's just gotten married for the second time because Lord Randolph has died, and the man she's married is Winston's age. Winston had a chance, though, just for a brief time, to be the Duke. This is his cousin, who was named Sonny, and this is Sonny's bride, the incredibly long-necked Consuelo Vanderbilt, who brought her millions, Vanderbilt millions, to the family to replenish their coffers because the previous dukes had all run through this money. Winston loved Consuelo. They got along very well, and she speaks very highly of him in her memoir. But she and Sonny didn't get along that well, and when she first married into the family, Winston's own grandmother brought her in and said, "My dear, you must have children, and they must be boys, because it would be intolerable if that upstart Winston became Duke." So even his own family regarded him as an upstart. And Winston, I've come to believe, would have regarded being a Duke as something inferior to what he aspired to, which was being Prime Minister. As I alluded to earlier, he had a lot of romantic interests. This has never been touched on. If you read any other biography of Churchill, you would think that he was completely sexless. But he was a passionate, romantic man, driven by all kinds of desires. And I thought, it can't simply be the case that he was avoiding women. In fact, one biography, the one that's usually regarded as the standard one, William Manchester, actually makes the case that Winston didn't even like women. Well, that's not true. In fact, he had an extraordinary string of women that he kept pursuing, I think in large part because he was looking for someone like his mother to be a kind of consort, a beautiful, attractive, energetic woman who would stand beside him and share with him this amazing career that he thought he was going to have. And he searched for that woman, and he wanted her to be incredibly special. So this is the first woman he fell in love with at the age of 25. This picture, it's very hard to find pictures of her, and I worked and worked to get it. This one's in the book. Because she was, everyone said, a beautiful woman, and yet I couldn't find any pictures of her until she was very old. This is a year after she's turned Winston down, or about a year and a half, and she's married an earl. And she's had her first child. And yet I think you can still see she was extraordinarily beautiful in this great Edwardian dress. This was Pamela Plowden. She became the Countess of Lytton. You know, Edward Bulwer Lytton, the man who's famous for writing a novel that began "It Was a Dark and Stormy Night." His family later was awarded an earldom, and one of his descendants married Pamela. She was the Countess of Lytton. So one woman who turned him down for an earl and thought she was getting the better deal. Winston tried to tell her, "No, I'll be the better deal," and she wouldn't listen. His mother, I was fascinated to learn, tried to counsel him in his efforts to win a consort. And so she told him to propose to Pamela in this spot. And it didn't work. And I thought, if you were in a punt, you know, one of those small flat-bottom boats, and you're going down the River Avon, of Shakespeare's Avon, in front of Castle Warwick, which this is, and it's a beautiful day like this, and you suddenly lean over and propose to Pamela, and she looks at you on a fine, it was a day in autumn, and says no, that would be devastating. That would be devastating. And Winston was, in fact, devastated and wouldn't take no, typically, for months at a time until finally she made it clear she wasn't going to accept him and married another, and then he had to give up. But he didn't really give up, because his next choice was the gorgeous Ethel Barrymore, American actress. He went to the theater in London, and she was performing in a play, and she wore that dress. I was able to find at the Library of Congress the picture of Ethel wearing that dress. And, of course, as you know, Drew Barrymore, she's the great aunt of Drew Barrymore. And there she is looking gorgeous in her 20s. Winston fell in love with her instantly. I mean, head over heels in love with her. And the story of how their relationship developed to the point where he proposed to her and why that fell through, I'm not going to tell you tonight. You have to read the book. But it's quite a story. It's very interesting how, because they loved each other. And, in fact, Ethel, many years later, would send telegrams to Winston when he was prime minister, reminding him again and again, you used to love me. You know, I was the one who was in love with you. What happened? Well, she knew what happened. But after 40 years. And by the way, Pamela, I also found a letter. It was recently auctioned off by Christie's, in which Pamela wrote to him on the 50th anniversary of that moment on the Avon and said to him, do you realize this is the 50th anniversary of the day you proposed to me? All the women he proposed to came to regret that they turned him down. And I think any man who had had these rejections would find it some vindication that 50 years later, the woman would write to you and say, remember, it was anniversary? Well, this one fell through too. And by the way, part of the fun of doing books like this, some people say to me, do you have anyone who does your research? No. I love research. I love doing it. I wouldn't give up that pleasure for anything. And here's an example of how you do this. In the Churchill archives, there is he kept diaries, and they were just appointment diaries. But you look at these, and you realize most people aren't going to look at them. And as you look at them, you try to see, is there anything that's going to, you know, be a clue of some sort? At the very bottom, you won't be able to make this out, but you can come up and look at it later if you want. But he's marked through that it's a debut with E.B., and it happened to be the night scheduled for a play that was going to debut with Ethel Barrymore. And he was scheduled to go to that. The play flopped. It was an enormous flop. Winston walked in afterwards into her dressing room and just looked at her and said, oh, my poor darling. And it's part of the reason their relationship fell apart. But as I was piecing all this together, and I had to completely reconstruct the story, because you will look through any number of books on Churchill and not find this, to understand how the timeline developed and how this relationship grew and then collapsed. In the middle of all this, he turned to a couple of women to help him out. Jenny's advice didn't work, so he turned to Consuelo. There he is on the left on the steps of Blenheim Palace, hiding playfully under Consuelo's big hat next to her big neck. And on the right, one of the women who never figures in any Churchill biography, but I fell in love with, it's Millicent Sutherland. She was the Duchess of Sutherland. And she was just a gorgeous character who threw great, elegant balls and was quite the woman of London. I mean, she was, everyone looked up to her, and she's kind of faded from history, but she was an early supporter of Winston's, and he adored her, but she was older and married. So she became one of these women who would sort of advise him and say, well, next time you should try this, or she'd do that, or here's a woman that might interest you. So here's the third woman. And I think the third woman gives you some idea of what he's looking for. The picture on the right is his mother. The picture on the left is the third woman, Muriel Wilson. And they're remarkably alike, aren't they? Muriel Wilson was gorgeous, better than this picture would suggest. In fact, I'll quickly show you. Here's another picture of Muriel. She's very attractive, but she also happened to be the richest woman in England. Today, her villa in the south of France on Cape Frat is owned by Paul Allen of Microsoft fame. And it hosts people like Brad and Angelina or whatever it is. All these people show up there today. But years ago, that belonged to the richest woman in England, Muriel Wilson. It wasn't her money, though, that interested Winston. He was just besotted with her. She was so glamorous. And she was an actress. And I discovered that she was an amateur actress because she didn't need the money, so she would appear in these theatricals. And one of the things she did in the Edwardian period was to dress up as various figures like war and peace and stand there and pose in these kind of vignettes. And I love the fact that one of her most famous vignettes was as the Muse of History. And I say in the book, how could Winston avoid dating the Muse of History? He loved her. He was just And you can see how desperate he is here when he writes to her. Perhaps I shall improve with waiting, because she turns him down not once but many times, because he's constantly coming back to her and say, would you marry me now? No. And then a few months later, would you marry me? No. So at one point, his letter, never quoted before, he says, perhaps I shall improve with waiting. Why shouldn't you care about me someday? Time and circumstance will work for me. Was there ever a more prophetic statement? Time and circumstance will work for me, from Winston Churchill. As he's pursuing these women, he's also developing his career. He's appointed early on to the colonial office. An earl happens to run the colonial office, and he's soon giving the earl orders. And I think I say in the book that only Winston Churchill could work for an earl and think that he was the boss. And here he is in a cartoon, pretty much lecturing his boss, and his boss is saying to him, why don't you go off and survey the colonies? Take a tour. You won't be missed. Go ahead. And Winston went ahead with that. While he was at the colonial office, he did something I think you'll find interesting. This is the scepter that the queen holds, and that enormous diamond in the top part there is a cut piece from the largest diamond ever found, the Cullinan diamond, found in South Africa. Winston had fought in the Boer War, and he was famous for escaping as a prisoner of the Boers. And so after he helped bring the Boer Transvaal Republic back into the empire, as a sort of tribute, the new prime minister, Botha, offered the king this enormous diamond. And both the king and the government turned it down. They thought, no, we can't take this. It was Winston who said, we will be remembered 100 years from now if we accept this diamond. It's a tribute from these people. We need to be friends with them. We can't remain enemies. Let's take the diamond. It was cut. It was placed one in the scepter, one in the crown. A couple of other pieces were put in other places. Winston had, though, before it was cut, a mold made of that bigger diamond. And every time that he would want to impress some guest at his house, he would ask the butler or somebody to bring that out on a little silver platter. One day, someone put the silver platter with this sort of milky-looking mold beside someone at the dinner table, and Winston forgot that he was supposed to explain it. And the person just looked down and said, no, thank you. Thinking it was a hardened jelly of some sort, and Winston lost all of his ability to impress them. This is a picture that's in black and white in the book, but I wanted you to see the color. This shows you what Winston was feeling as he stood in that rubble, because he would face men like this from a young age, fighting against Arthur Balfour and the father of Neville Chamberlain, Joe Chamberlain, who was a great powerhouse in the Edwardian period. Joe had 12 greenhouses full of orchids and used to wear them all in his lapel. Orchids, people would say, as big as a fist. And he wore a monocle, and he was just an incredibly impressive character. And these men were twice Winston's age, and they were his real nemesis. He fought with them as though he were on the same level with them. And because they dominated the Tory party, Winston made the extraordinary decision to leave the Tories. He couldn't get along with these two, and join the Liberals. And they sort of welcomed his departure because he was more trouble than he was worth as far as they were concerned. And these two men accepted him. This is David Lloyd George on the left, on the right, and Herbert Asquith on the left, these famous names from British politics. They saw in Winston an up-and-coming man. And at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, when I was researching the book, they brought this picture out to me, and they said, this is part of our Asquith exhibit. You can see that this is Asquith at his home in Sutton Courtney, and he's speaking with David Lloyd George. And I looked at the photograph, and I said, no, it isn't. And they looked at me, upstart American, I suppose. And I said, no, that's not all it is. And they said, well, what else is it? I said, that's Winston in the background with Violet Asquith, one of the women who loved him dearly. And to see this and to notice that people had never even noticed that Winston, in his very characteristic pose, is back in the back at the house with the prime minister's daughter was quite a shock to them. But it's a great picture, and it's also prelude to the most interesting romantic adventure, and it involves this woman. This is Violet Asquith. Many people who've read my book say they root for Violet to marry Winston because she's an incredible woman. Her stepmother said she would have made a great man. And by that, by that she meant that untypically for the Edwardian woman of the time, she could discuss politics and world events and everything as though she was in Parliament herself. She loved politics. She was her father's daughter. Her father was prime minister. She adored Winston and adored him from the beginning because he lived, he ate and breathed politics, and the two of them would just get off together and talk for hours together. Later in life, someone said to her, well, she said, people have asked me, was Winston full of his own rhetoric? And she says, I don't know. I only know that I was. She loved listening to him. She would hang on his every word. She adored him. But she wasn't the woman he was looking for because she wasn't this. She had a kind of unconventional beauty about her. She was a beautiful young woman. I've been told that one of Churchill's granddaughters described her in old age as homely. Well, Churchill was no great prize in old age either as far as that goes. But when they were young, they were quite a pair. And to some extent, I feel, and many readers have felt, that these two should have married. And yet again, you'll look through all the Churchill biographies to find any reference to Violet, and you won't find a thing or just a passing mention. And yet this was an extraordinary relationship. And the really dramatic thing is that Winston pretty much decides he might as well propose to Violet. And he's on the verge of doing that when he falls in love with this woman. This is Clementine, the woman he does marry. It's his fourth time to propose, and he's divided between Violet on the one hand and Clementine on the other. He decides to ask Clementine first, and she just floors him by saying yes. He's so used to being turned down by these beautiful women that he thinks she won't take him, and he will settle. I don't think he would have been settling, but he will settle for Violet. When she accepts, he has a problem. Because he's told Violet that he's going to come up to this remote castle on the coast of Scotland above Aberdeen and spend the summer with her, her father's summer retreat. And it'll probably be prelude to the engagement. So now when Clementine accepts, he has to decide what to do. He immediately tells Clementine during the preparations for their marriage, they're going to get married in just 4 weeks after he proposes. He doesn't want to take any chances. But as she's scurrying around town, getting ready for this marriage, he tells her, oh, by the way, I have to go on an 1,100-mile round-trip journey from London to north of Aberdeen to Slane's Castle, that's the name of the place, to see Violet and tell her I'm not marrying her. Clemmy blows up. She threatens to cancel the marriage. And Winston, to his credit, goes ahead. He says, well, if you have to do that, do. But I must explain to Violet. So he goes on this trip, and my wife and I decided one day flying back into Heathrow I wanted to do it, but I couldn't do it in the old-fashioned way of taking the train up. It doesn't quite run the same way. So I just rented a car from Heathrow and drove in a single day this journey all the way up England and into Scotland, past Edinburgh and past Aberdeen and up to Slane's Castle. We arrived there late in the evening, as Winston would have, because I wanted to get a sense of what this involved for him. That he had to go there and say this to Violet. Meanwhile, he does get married, and it's a blow to Violet. But before we get to that, what happened after the marriage, I want to show you Slane's Castle, because this is where he shows up. Hanging off of one of these cliffs, I took this picture, and it wasn't such a good idea, because the grass there is very soft, and it's peaty-like. And as I was down this cliff taking this picture of the castle, I started to make my way forward, And I was having trouble getting my footing in the grass, and I thought, well, if I just sort of push myself forward, I'll get some footing and go. Something told me not to do that, and a good idea, because on the other side of this was a 150-foot drop into one of those ravines. Well, this is Slane's Castle, and today it's a relic, it's a ruin, but this is how extraordinary a place it is. Look at this view from the castle out of the North Sea. It's here that Winston arrives, and it's a very dramatic moment because he wants to say to Violet, I still care about you deeply. Your father's important to me, my career. He is the prime minister. I don't want to alienate you, but this other woman has said yes. I didn't think she would. It's an incredible moment, and Violet does not take it well. While they are talking this out over about 3 days, she gets the idea they should go rock climbing. And when I first read this in the Asquith papers in the Bodleian, I thought, are they crazy? because I'd just been up there. And I thought, I wouldn't climb on those rocks. She actually fell and cut herself on the cheek and ripped it open. And it was a bad cut. And she used that as an excuse for when Winston said, well, I have to go. You know, Clemmie's waiting for me. I'm going to get married. As an excuse for not attending the wedding, even though her own cousin, Venetia Stanley, was one of the bridesmaids. So it was a dramatic moment where the two of them know that they've disappointed each other. And yet they part. A week later, Violet went missing. And she went missing at night, and they organized a search to find her. This is what the castle looked like in her day on the lower part. And above you will see the incredible isolation of it. If you go missing at night in that area, you're presumed dead. And in fact, they spent until well after midnight hunting for her, searching for her. And they couldn't find her. As it turns out, she was lying on the ledge of one of those cliffs. She had dropped herself there. She was, I think, in a desperate attempt to call attention to... Winston was on his honeymoon. And I think she felt abandoned and hurt, and she just wanted the attention. When they found her, her stepmother was angry because when they realized she hadn't been hurt, that she had forced everybody to look for her in the dark. The villagers had been called out. A lot of people put their lives at risk looking for her. They realized that this was a very unhappy girl crying out for attention, and it created a scandal. It was hushed up and has been for 100 years until revealed in this book. And I was stunned at the effect this had had on her. She, though, recovered not only physically from this, she wasn't hurt, but you know, emotionally she recovered, and she became the greatest advocate at No. 10 Downing Street for Winston's career. Within 3 years, he was the head of the British Navy. He wanted to be the head of the Navy because it was important to him. She helped him get that job. She was with him toward the end of his life. She would come and sit with him when he was an old man. They were sort of like a separate couple in many ways, and Clemmie resented that. In fact, she used to joke that when Violet found out that Clementine and Winston were getting married, that she fainted, and she did faint. So there was this sort of secret rivalry there. The woman who shared Winston's mind but didn't quite have the other things he was looking for. And I think as you read the book, you'll wonder if he made the right choice. There were many things good about Clementine, but I think Violet had his mind. Clemmie had his heart. And this dramatic episode was one that it's at the center of the book. I also want to show you quickly, in London, you can still track Churchill's footsteps, literally. And it's extraordinary. People would say to me when I was starting to write this book, oh, surely we know everything about Winston Churchill. And I'd say, I don't think so. And then here's a good example. Here you see Winston standing on the steps of that house on the right. It was an important house because he launched his career as a cabinet member there. And you see him standing on the very checkered steps that are still there. The house is still pretty much as it was. I knocked on the door one day. A nice woman let me in. It was a real estate office, basically. And they showed me around, and they had changed very little. It was extraordinary. There was not a plaque on the house. There was nothing whatsoever to indicate that the most famous British person of the 20th century once lived there and had an important part of his career there. So it's amazing how much of Churchill has not been explored, including, say, things like this. This is a great photo of Churchill lecturing a crowd trying to get their vote. And in the distance, this photograph's never been reproduced. It's in the book. And in the distance is a suffragette trying to drown him out with a cowbell so that every time he would speak, she would ring the bell. Winston was in favor of suffrage for women, but not after he was subject to a lot of this harassment. And one of the great women of the suffrage movement, Mrs. Pakenham, was asked, why did you target Winston? He supported suffrage. Said, well, he was in our district because he represented a suburb of Manchester, and their headquarters were in Manchester. And he was the easiest for us to target. We wanted to tell the Liberal government, you need to introduce suffrage for women. So we went after him. He was also involved in putting down anarchists in London as Home Secretary. He was in charge of executing people. He gave the last word when he was Home Secretary to whether someone should be executed. And I found this list. It was called the death sentence list. And he had to write at the side of each man's name, either executed or respited, meaning either he rescinded the sentence, he put them on a kind of reprieve, or he went ahead and had the execution. And there are many great stories about that. But the triumph of his life is becoming the head of the British Navy. And there he has, in the early years leading up to World War I, the same job he has in the years leading up to World War II, warning against a German threat, preparing the British to fight that threat, in this case with the Navy, so that when Britain's again faced with a threat from Germany in 1939, they bring Winston back to be the head of the Navy again. And the great cry that went out at the time is, Winston's back. Because as the head of the Navy before World War I, he helped to build a modern fleet. The yacht he had to travel in as the head of the Admiralty was enormous, and he had great fun on that. Here he is with Clemmy, traveling around with her. Here he is on the deck of the yacht with the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister is reading a paper, and Winston in this cartoon says, "Is there any news at home?" And the Prime Minister supposedly says, "How can there be with you here?" Winston goes flying. He develops the air arm of the British Navy, and I'm going through this rather quickly so we can have time for questions, so bear with me about this. And even I discovered his wife, Clemmy. I really began to like her a lot at this point, where she went up in a plane too, and in this letter she describes her attempt to sort of compete with Winston. He's flying in these rickety old early Sopwith camels, and she goes up in one of them, and at the end of that letter, Winston, she says, came to her after she got out of the plane and said, "Never again," because it frightened him to death to see her up there. And I love this picture because this is one of the admirals who wins World War II at sea, or World War I at sea for the British, and he was appointed to his position by Churchill. But doesn't Admiral Beatty look like someone from Central Casting to play a British admiral? He's terrific. Even the press had to finally give in and say Winston was the champion of the British Navy. Here he is depicted with Neptune as this almost supernatural force who's blowing into the air this new British air fleet to work in concentration with the Navy. But all this fell apart, as you'll discover in the book, and this is the extraordinary thing. When Winston, in the first year of the war, made the mistake of having his reputation associated with the ill-fated Gallipoli expedition, isn't that an unbelievably young-looking Mel Gibson? As a young Australian plane in what the Aussies still regard as a great disaster, many Australians were killed. They tried to go through the Straits of the Dardanelles to get up to Turkey. They were trying, because the Western Front had pretty much just come to a standstill, they were trying to go around it and create a diversion and draw the Germans away, open a second front. It didn't work. Winston was not the sole person proposing it. Many people were. But he had made so many enemies on the way up, he got the blame. And he was thrown out of government. And I want to show you this last photograph to indicate this is the yin and the yang of this thing. The earlier photos you see, the young man of promise and confidence. This I find an extraordinary photograph because after they blame him for the Dardanelles disaster, the Gallipoli disaster, he's thrown out of the government. He has nothing to do. The war is grinding on. And he decides he might as well go to the front and fight as an ordinary, first a major. Then he's promoted to lieutenant colonel. He goes to the trenches and he writes an incredible letter quoted for the first time in my book, in which he says to his wife, "It's to be open in case of my death." Pretty much kind of his view of his life up to 40, because he doesn't think he'll live longer. He thinks he's going to the trenches to die. And he has several close calls there, and he really should have been killed. And for me, this is the real dividing line between the Winston that I write about and the Winston that you know, the famous one, because this one should have died in 1915 when he was 40. He thought he should have died. And this picture of him is a picture of a soul in pain who nevertheless is soldiering on, who nevertheless is not giving up, is remaining Winston. And I find this photo extraordinary because he's looking straight into the camera as though to say, "I could be dead tomorrow, but damn it, I fought to the end." And if you want to know why he was the perfect person for 1940 and 1941, that picture will tell you why he was. He was the kind of person who simply would not accept defeat in any form, in any part of life. And that's somebody I find immensely inspirational. Thank you.
Listening to Michael Sheldon, the author of Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. at the Commonwealth Club of California here in San Francisco. It's time for questions and answers, and I think we can start with, if you want to share, that letter that he wrote from there about what he predicted his death to be. I thought those were great words.
It's an extraordinary letter because he writes as though he's a ghost. I mean, he already feels it, and he's trying to justify his career. He's basically trying to tell himself, I did everything I thought I was supposed to do. Why did it all fall apart? And he has answers, but most of all, it's just inspirational because he says to her, you know, be true to my memory, guard the children. You know, it's an incredible statement in which a man thinking of himself now beyond the grave, talking back to say, you know, I lived it my way. It almost sounds like a Frank Sinatra song in a sense, but it's Winston Churchill telling his wife in the most private and poignant way what he thought he had done with his life up until that age. And many people are not left with a dry eye at the end of that book. That's how I choose to end it, because in a way he saw that as the end of the young Titan. And it would take another 25 years, think about that, for him to rise again. So when you fail just extraordinarily, I mean, you just utter complete failure, and everyone writes you off and you think you're pretty much ready for death, and you have to wait another 25 years to realize your destiny, that wait of 25 years is extraordinary.
All right, question.
You haven't spoken about Churchill's career as a writer, as a reporter and novelist. Could you make a few remarks about that?
Yes. By the way, what you have up here are the covers of the two editions of the book. It's published throughout the British-speaking world in the cover on the left, and then the American and Canadian editions is the one on the right. But I've done interviews with people in India and Australia and Singapore, all over the world, because the British edition is going out to all those places. It's extraordinary how much interest there is in Winston, and part of it has to do with his talent for words. He is a wordsmith, and it comes out very early on. I love this comment that he makes when he says, I believe in personality. And you think, what do you mean by that? And what he meant was, I believe in the force, the magnetic power of a personality to change things. It was the old great man theory of history. And I think he believed very powerfully in that, and he thought his tool was language. The famous quote about him in World War II is he mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. And that's exactly what he did. And I think Hitler was intimidated by that. He was already positioned, I think, to be intimidated by Churchill because he knew his history. But he also knew that Winston could mobilize the British people, and he did, to put up a resistance that others might not have inspired them to do. He did win the Nobel Prize, and he won it for literature because he earned his living throughout his life as a writer. That's how he made most of his money. And people forget that. I point out, because I'm an English professor, how much of an inspiration writing was to him and literature was to him. His great favorite was the poet Lord Byron. And in fact, as you'll see, he knew Byron so well, he was a member of the Byron Society, that he borrowed a bit of Byron for his famous speech about blood and toil and sweat and tears. And I'll let you discover that. But he was inspired by literature and knew literature very well. So as a writer, he prospered, but also as a politician. Can you imagine our politicians today quoting Lord Byron and knowing Byron backwards and forwards? He really did have a great grounding in British literature.
If I remember correctly, he was born at Blenheim, as you showed, but I think there was a race to get Jenny there, to have him there.
There was, yes.
Because he was kind of his father, and they were kind of reluctantly embraced, or not even embraced by the family, if I remember right. And so his father wanted to make sure that he was born there.
Yes.
In like a back room. Is that correct, if I
yes,
remember right?
Yes, it is. The idea was to make him aware from an early age, from the beginning, that he was part of this legacy. But the rest of the family never quite accepted him, and I think they didn't because of his mother.
Yeah.
She was always seen as the outsider.
Well, I always felt that was contributed a lot to his character, because he was kind of like the ne'er-do-well relative of this illustrious family.
He got used to playing that part. You're right. Yeah. And that's a tough part to play, by the way, in British society.
Question.
Did you touch on, in your book, did you touch on the fact that that blue period was when he started painting?
Yes, I do. In fact, there's a great moment where this old poet, Wilfred Scawen Blunt, comes to him to investigate. He hears that Winston's in despair. This is before he goes to the front. It was about a six-month period where he's been kicked out of the government. He has nothing to do. He takes up painting. And as he's painting this canvas, Blunt comes, guy with a white beard, by the way, married the granddaughter of Byron, a friend of Churchill's, partly for that reason. And he comes and he looks at Winston, and Winston just turns around to him and says, there's more than paint on these fingers, there's blood. So he was very much aware that he had gotten Britain into a war and wasn't there to help see it through to the end, and that many men had died on his watch, and he felt terrible that he couldn't continue to be a part of it. That's why he finally set down the paintbrushes and said, I'm going off to fight. And the book, my book, ends with this incredible moment, not just of that letter, but of a going away party in which all of his remaining friends, and there aren't many of them, come to essentially say goodbye. And they mean goodbye forever because they don't think he's coming back. And it's a very brave moment on Churchill's part. Yes.
Yes, could you elaborate a bit on his relationship with Jackie Fisher, who saved the British Navy?
Jackie Fisher was a genius and a madman, and you never knew which one was going to show up. The genius helped to devise the modern British Navy. He developed those huge dreadnoughts with their first 13-inch guns and then 15-inch guns, and just they thought they would rule the waves because of this enormous navy that Admiral Fisher had built up. But by the time he's involved with Churchill at the outbreak of the First World War, he's in his 70s and he's getting a little crazy. And he talks Winston into doing all sorts of things. Initially, he's the big proponent of going into the Dardanelles and the Gallipoli Peninsula. And then when he sees things going wrong, he's the first to back out and quickly blame Winston. And in fact, he goes to Winston's enemies in the Conservative Party and says, if you want to know who to blame for the disaster that's happening out there, it's Winston Churchill. So he stabs him in the back. And by that time, it's a terrible tragedy for both men, because they basically liked each other a lot and looked up to each other and thought of themselves as a kind of mentor-protege thing. But when things went bad, Jackie wasn't one to take the blame. He shifted it to Winston.
What is your take on Churchill's view of colonialism? It seemed that he was rather behind the times. Didn't he support the British Empire until the very end of his life?
Again, this is where the two Churchills comes to be very interesting. My Churchill's a progressive, a full out-and-out liberal who introduces social legislation to establish a kind of safety net for the British working class. He's the first person, the Oxford English Dictionary gives him credit for this, to use the phrase social security in the modern sense. Everybody acknowledges within the Liberal Party, he's taking them straight down the path of what would eventually be the welfare state. And people are shocked to hear this about Churchill. But in many ways, the disappointments that he suffered changed his attitude and hardened them. Early on, he was a kind of ambivalent supporter of the colonial project. He loved the empire, but he knew that it was doing a lot of damage to native peoples. And he actually, at the colonial office, steps in to stop some of these punitive expeditions against colonial people, native people in the colonies in Africa. So he's quite a different character, but after the disappointments, that's when he puts on weight, that's when he starts to drink. And I mean, if we had to wait those 25 years, probably the rest of us would fall into those things too. And like many people getting older, his views harden around certain things. So the Churchill that often gets accused of being the racist and all these other things, I think that's not fair or just, but it's certainly not true of the young Churchill. He's quite a different person, both in his political outlook and in his just his moral character. He's a much tougher character, by the way, in those early 20s and 30s than at any other time in his life. I think when he's calling on that toughness at 65, he's pulling it all the way back from his 30s.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering, what was your most memorable discovery during this research? And if you don't want to do a spoiler, like if you can reference a chapter, I'll look up.
Well, I think it was this relationship with Violet, because it opened up everything for me. It showed me what a double-edged sword a politician faces if his best friend in the government is the prime minister, and the prime minister has a lovely, intelligent daughter, and you're unmarried, and three women have rejected you. So for me, this opened up something I hadn't dreamed about Churchill, that he was put in this kind of romantic dilemma where he was genuinely attracted to Violet, but you can see the problem. If you're the prime minister's son-in-law, it can be good for your career, but also bad. If you're promoted, people will say it's because you're the son-in-law of the prime minister. If the prime minister's career suffers, you go down with it. So I think he was, from the start, worried about this problem of Violet, the most interesting woman he had ever known in his life. And yet, because she's the prime minister's daughter, a woman he has to be wary of marrying because of all the problems it will involve in his career. So when he goes up to Slane's Castle, I love that name, to have this meeting with her, you couldn't get more dramatic, because he has to say, this is what I'm going to do, and I hate doing it, but this is what I have to do, and she doesn't take it well either. And the fact that they're able to slowly rebuild their relationship is quite incredible. And that in later years, by the way, many people would come to Chartwell and see Churchill as an old man sitting out in a chair looking out over his property there, with an old hat stuck over his head, and it would be Violet sitting beside him. They were, as I said, almost like an old couple together. And as probably some of you know, Clemmie had an affair with a man in the 1930s. She went on a cruise and fell in love with a man. And Winston seemed to kind of roll with the punches on that. And I think it's because he was more in the line of what William Manchester says, the fellow who had lost a lot of interest in relationships because politics had come to immerse him entirely. And he suffered a lot of disappointments in his personal life. His son didn't turn out that well. One of his daughters committed suicide. A lot of people thought that Clementine wasn't that great a mother. There are all sorts of speculations about this. Like many married couples, they sort of grew apart. And I can't help but think Violet would have been maybe the better woman for the long haul. She was an extraordinary woman. And by the way, you may not be aware of this, but she's the grandmother of Helena Bonham Carter, the actress. And that's because when Winston wouldn't accept her, and I find this quite telling, she waited several years, still sort of maybe hoping Winston would come back. And finally in 1915, when he was sent away to fight, on his birthday, November 30th, she married in the same church that he had married Clementine, a man named Maurice Bonham Carter that she really wasn't that crazy about. But she married him, and they had children, and her granddaughter is Helena Bonham Carter, the actress today. Isn't that something? That's Violet Asquith. Yeah. I think she's one of the great characters in history, and she's been totally forgotten.
Great. One more question.
Some people have said Churchill was the man of the 20th century. Would you agree with that in comparing him to maybe Roosevelt and a few of the others that might come to mind?
Maybe the man of the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, yes.
Well, that was my next question. Even comparing him to Washington or Lincoln or something like that,
they're
difficult to compare, obviously, different eras, but how would you stack him up in that ranking?
Well, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I think he's underestimated. I think Winston Churchill was one of the most impressive men, certainly in history. And he was tested in a way that most people aren't. We know that Lincoln is tested in the Civil War and that he was tested very severely. But if you think about the test that Hitler faced in looking across those waters at Churchill, and then the test that Churchill himself faces in thinking, what am I going to do? That feud, that standoff between Adolf Hitler, who at that moment is beginning the process of killing methodically 6 million human beings. There's nothing like that in our Civil War. There's slavery and everything else, but there aren't death camps that are just, you know, turning into factories of death. And Churchill's the only man who has a chance of stopping him. So when that person steps up and does that at that point in history, you know, maybe other people would have too, but he's the one in the right place at the right time that makes the right decision, and thank God. He did.
That's a perfect end. Yeah. Thank you very much. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
And I'll sign books out there if you want.
And Michael's available if you want the book. Michael's available to sign them.